Hello, everyone. Today's Friday, the 24th of June, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, voters in the United Kingdom have defied the advice of economists and their own leaders. They have decided to leave the European Union. It will cost them their leader, David Cameron.
I do not think it would be right for me to try to be the captain that steers our country to its next destination.
We will go live to London, to Brussels, and to New York City to cover the story for you. Also ahead, you will hear about a story dealing with Whitney Houston, the late Whitney Houston, and some attempts to sell her award when the award she has won. All that coming up on International Edition. We start out, as you might expect, with the Brexit story, the exit of the UK from the European Union. They voted by a narrow margin to break away from the EU, a move that some European leaders are labeling a grave mistake. More than 70% of the registered voters participated in the referendum, which passed by a margin of nearly 4%. This referendum was seen by many Leave supporters as reflecting British sentiment on immigration, sovereignty, security, and Britain's economic future. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for U.S. president, lauded the decision to leave the EU.
People want to take their country back, and they want to have independence, in a sense, and you see it with Europe, all over Europe. You're going to have more than just, in my opinion, more than just what happened last night. You're going to have, I think, many other cases where they want to take their borders back. They want to take their monetary back. They want to take a lot of things back. They want to be able to have a country again. But I really do see a parallel between what's happening in the United States and what's happening here. People want to see borders. They don't necessarily want people pouring into their country that they don't know who they are and where they come from. They have no idea. And I think, you know, it not only did it win, but it won by a much bigger margin than people thought it would happen.
Trump was in Scotland to make that announcement. He flew over there to open a golf course, the famous Turnbull Golf Links in Scotland that he has taken over. Well, back to politics. Trump's likely opponent in the presidential race, former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, said in a statement, "We respect the choice the people of the United Kingdom have made. The chief task now," she said, "is to make sure that the economic uncertainty created by these events doesn't hurt working families here in America." America, while also making it clear that America's steadfast commitment to the special relationship with Britain and the transatlantic alliance with Europe continues. Well, President Obama said in a statement, "The people of the United Kingdom have spoken. We respect their decision." He added that the special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. is enduring, and that the latter's membership in NATO remains a vital cornerstone of U.S. foreign security and economic policy. We have Luis Ramirez, VOA's correspondent, joining us from London, Henry Ridgewell from Brussels, and Jill Malandrino, who is following the markets from New York City, also Andrew Palczewski, who is checking in on social media. So let's start our discussion about what has happened with Luis Ramirez. Luis, how much of a surprise was this to the people of the U.K.?
The best way to describe this is as an earthquake in every way, politically, economically. The polls going into this referendum were pointing to at least a narrow lead by the Remain camp, and that's not what happened in the early hours of Friday. Very quickly, the numbers started showing a decisive lead by those who favored exiting from the European Union.
Well, David Cameron resigned soon after the results came in. Was that expected as well, if indeed the outcome came out the way it did?
That was widely predicted. He's just put so much at stake in this campaign to remain in the EU, pretty much his whole political future. He emerged as the leader of the Remain campaign, and so the thought was that if he loses that, he will lose his mandate, and that's pretty much what happened. What was a surprise was that he announced his resignation so quickly after the final results came in, because he had said just days before that he would not resign.
What changes are expected? What do you hear during the time it's going to take for the Brits to make their exit from the EU, which, by the way, is not immediate, right?
No, absolutely not. In fact, what this is when you look at it in purely legal terms, it's an advisory from the people to their government as to what they want them to do, what they want that government to do in regard to EU membership. Of course, any government that wants to maintain its mandate will follow that advice. But essentially, what happens is that it would take a minimum of 2 years for the UK to leave the EU. That is what needs to happen. Is the government of the UK needs to invoke what's known as Article 50 of the European Union Treaty that establishes an off-ramp, if you would. It's not really ever been used before. The last time anyone exited was Greenland in 1985, when it did not exist as the European Union. And so there is no playbook. There is no way to really map out how this is going to happen. But I can tell you that what they do need to do in order to begin this, what promises to be a rather messy divorce, is to, lay out the terms of what this departure will be like. Look at financial regulations, see what still applies, trade tariffs, and also one big concern is the movement of people. Right now, although Britain is not a party to the Schengen agreement, UK citizens can travel visa-free throughout the European Union, and vice versa. EU citizens can come here not only to travel but to work more fundamentally, and that's a huge issue, something that is causing a great deal of anxiety among many people on both sides of the English Channel.
Luis, stay where you are, if you don't mind, in front of the microphone in London, because I want to talk to you about what the subject of immigration and emigration had to do with this. But let's head to Brussels now, the city that houses the headquarters of the EU. VOA's Henry Ridgewell is there. Henry, the European Council President Donald Tusk in Berlin on Monday said that Britain made, he said on Friday, actually, that Britain made a mistake if it leaves the EU, which is the world's largest single market. He said that will have consequences. What kind of consequences do you see ahead on this?
Well, in the short term, we've already seen the consequences of that with wild gyrations on the financial markets and on the currency markets, both for the pound and to a lesser extent the euro. But further down the track, all of these treaties, all of the trade agreements that exist at the moment between Britain and the European Union, but also between Britain and other countries around the world, will have to be torn up and rewritten. And nobody knows at the moment exactly what those treaties will end up looking like. So the implications for Britain's exports and imports is as yet unknown. And there are two theories about the path that this could take. Will it be that economics takes precedence in Britain's negotiations to leave the EU, that all the countries of the EU want to keep those economic channels open and there isn't much impact on trade between Britain and the European Union? Or will politics prevail and will the unity of the European Union take precedence? Will the European Union make sure that Britain is to an extent punished so that no other members of the European Union will want to take the same route and to preserve that unity? As Luis was saying there, nobody has ever done this before. Nobody's left the European Union, so there's no blueprint to follow. There's no model. Nobody knows what the next 2 years or possibly even longer of negotiations are going to look like. And as we all know, markets and currencies and businesses hate uncertainty, and that could wreak economic damage both on Britain and on Europe.
And we'll get to Jill Melandrino in New York on that in just a second. But as you heard Donald Trump say, and he's not the only one who's been saying it, that several European leaders are seeing this vote in Britain as an opportunity to push for similar referendums in their countries. Can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, already in the past 24 hours, since the result of that vote has been known, we've had Geert Wilders of the Freedom Party in the Netherlands, who is currently polling the most popular party in that country, call for a referendum on EU membership there. We've had Marine Le Pen, the head of the National Front in France, call for a referendum there. And we've had the Lega Nord, a separatist anti-EU party in Italy, call for referendums there. We've got Catalonian and Basque separatists in Spain eyeing this referendum and wondering if it offers them a chance to break away from Spain. As we've already described, we've got Scotland and Northern Ireland considering their futures inside the United Kingdom, let alone the European Union. So this has opened a Pandora's box. that EU leaders here in Brussels are desperate to close, but it remains to be seen whether they can or whether this this huge move by the United Kingdom will trigger some kind of domino effect across the continent.
Luis Ramirez in London, you heard Henry just mention the that Scotland, their vote was to stay in the EU, but they're part of the UK. So does that lead to another push for independence, do you think?
Well, that was certainly the warning today from the Scottish First Minister, who said that she is beginning a legal process to carry out a referendum like that. It just seemed like as Friday wore on, the news kept getting more dire in terms of what the future of Britain and Europe, what the face of it would look like by the time this is all over. And so, Scotland would now be having what would be its second referendum if this goes through. Such a move would have to be approved by Westminster. There is some hope among some people here that in these months to come, before anybody lifts a finger on disengagement from the EU, I'm talking about October when the new prime minister takes over, that will serve perhaps as a cooling off period. But certainly the pronouncement was very direct, very clear from the Scottish First Minister that the process is going to get underway.
Joe Malandrino in New York, who covers finance for us here on International Edition. Uncertainty, that's always a phrase and a word that makes people step back on Wall Street, doesn't it?
Very true. I agree with exactly what Henry said. And I feel like since we've been talking about this the past 3-4 weeks, it's almost a mantra. The markets hate uncertainty. And that was, I think, the biggest issue with the vote. It was the contagion effect. So as you were saying before, you have all these other peripheral movements occurring now. In terms of the market reaction, the most obvious was the 8% move on the pound, plunging to its lowest level since 1985. We saw broad declines in the metals and energy sectors. The financials, of course, were hit the hardest, especially the European banks like Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, UBS, Barclays. Gold, of course, it's viewed as a safe haven asset, so that surged more than 5%. We saw a surge in the yen as well. That's also viewed as a safe haven asset. But I want to put this into perspective for everyone a little bit. The Dow was up 500 points in the last 5 days and was down roughly the same amount in the pre-market. So basically, we are where we were just last Thursday. A 500-point move in the Dow in just 5 days, it's pretty remarkable. Same thing with the S&P 500 futures. We are still within the range that we've been trading since mid-March. Anywhere from 2030 to 2100 on the S&P is that range. So perhaps this could be a buying opportunity if you're looking at technical levels. But, you know, back to the uncertainty theme, what to do as a retail investor, because this is all over the news, whether it's entertainment news, financial media, political media. There is no escape from talking about Brexit, but for the average retail investor, I wouldn't panic. This is not like 1987, even though some in the media have suggested that. Like anything else, let these isolated situations play themselves out and don't try in market time. If you got out of the market when we were at the absolute low during the financial crisis, you missed almost a 300% move if you would have pulled your money out.
Joe, thank you. I want to ask both Luis and Henry, in very little time that we have left, about the issue of immigration. Luis, how much did that play a part?
Center stage, really. That was the big issue driving people on the Brexit, in the Brexit camp. They cite the reality that Britain's immigration rate has doubled in 16 years. That's something that has caused a great deal of unease. And so that's what's cited. Now, the people that one interviews here on the street who have an opinion on the matter, and most people do, well, the reason that most people give for being worried about immigration is that while it has brought in a large number of very skilled workers, mainly from the EU, those workers have been willing to work for less money, and that has driven wages down for British nationals. So that's the chief complaint.
All right. Henry in Brussels. Henry Ridgewell, what part does immigration play?
Well, immigration and the freedom of movement of people across the European Union is one of the key pillars of the Union itself. And the European Union made it clear in the negotiations with Britain earlier this year that it is a non-negotiable principle. And that's why David Cameron came home empty-handed from his negotiations in February on that matter. And the European Union simply isn't going to budge on that. And that's why we are where we are today.
Well, I thank everyone for taking part in this discussion. Hopefully it has shed some light on what has happened today and around the world. Luis Ramirez in London, Henry Ridgewell in Brussels, Jill Malandrino in New York, and coming up now, Andrew Palcheski, who has been following social media. And how much has this story taken over social media?
Well, let me give you some perspective. When I was monitoring social media this morning, and as the vote was announced even last night, every single trending topic on Twitter worldwide was related to Brexit. This is something that only happens when there's a major terrorist attack or a major celebrity death or something really significant worldwide. So that really speaks to how much this Brexit vote is going to impact the world. And we've seen all throughout the day today the social media continue. Now, something that always happens on Fridays on social media is Flashback Friday. It's one of those hashtags you see consistently where people post old photos and things like that. Well, two tweets that I saw that I was struck by. One's a Flashback Friday to this past April, President Obama making a trip to the UK, where he said in very stark terms, the UK will go to the back of the queue if they vote to leave. And so a lot of people are saying, well, does this mean that they are indeed going to go to the back of the queue as far as trade deals and things like that? President Obama's come out and said that he respects the decision of the voters. We're going to preserve the special relationship with the UK. But there's a lot of questions about what that will mean. Another Flashback Friday I saw was just somebody put a picture of the EU flag and said, flashback, remember when UK was in the EU? Well, it's a new day and they're not anymore. Even though it's going to take 2 years to negotiate, it's already resonating. And resonating with the voters, too. I saw a couple clips on social media of some voters with maybe voter remorse. They said, well, if I could go back to yesterday, I would vote to remain. I voted to get out, and now I'm really realizing what that means.
A little late, might I?
Yeah. Well, one guy, too, he said, I voted for the Brexit, and I didn't think my vote would matter. And sure enough, it did. So a lot of voters who are kind of questioning that. And as Jill said, this is impacting a lot of areas. It's, you know, certainly finance and geopolitics, but we're seeing questions about sports, the European Premier League, whether that's going to be impacted, tourism, and even entertainment, which Game of Thrones, the popular TV show, may have to move where they record because and where they tape that show because of this Brexit. So impacting really all facets of life and social media, depending on what you're interested in, you're honing on those different things.
Andrew Palcheski, as always, thanks for being with us with a look at social media. This is VOA. VOA's International Edition continues now. Here in Washington, Democrats in the Congressional House of Representatives a couple days ago ended a 26-hour sit-in in the House chamber. This thing was unprecedented, a protest against what they say is the lack of legislative action on gun violence by their Republican colleagues. VOA's House correspondent, Catherine Gibson, has been following the developments, and International Edition's Michael Lippin spoke to her about the sit-in and what the Democrats think they achieved with that protest.
They felt that they had reached a point, they had reached the 24-hour mark and gone a little bit past it, and they felt that they had made the world aware of their goals and their hopes for legislation. They said that when they come back after the July 4th holiday break, they'll continue this fight, and the break will be an opportunity to talk to their constituents, strategize about next steps forward, and see where they take this fight next.
Well, you know, House Speaker Paul Ryan, he continued his criticism of the sit-in today, saying it was a fundraising tool for the Democrats. Do we know that the Democrats actually were able to raise any money based off of the publicity they got for this protest?
You know, it's unclear if they were able to raise any money. They certainly had a large group of supporters here around Capitol Hill last night through the morning and into today when they ended the sit-in. A lot of people supporting their calls for gun violence legislation. And, you know, I'm certain that the images that were beamed around the world on Periscope and on Facebook Live will do their part in encouraging people to donate to the cause.
What do the Democrats think they can do next to actually achieve progress toward their goal? Are we going to see basically a repeat sit-in after the 4th of July?
They were very careful about answering that question today when they ended their sit-in outside the Capitol. They spoke in very broad terms about next steps, about strategizing, and mostly about building a dialogue with their Republican colleagues. You know, I saw a couple of members of Congress shout out to their Republican colleagues on the House floor late last night trying to start that dialogue. And, of course, they were shouted down, and then there was the back and forth. So we can see if maybe in a little less heated atmosphere, a little bit of that dialogue can begin.
Well, I was just going to ask you, given that there were some House Republicans who were quite angered at how the Democrats were breaking the House rules with this sit-in, do you think that the protest makes the possibility of a compromise between Democrats and Republicans more likely or less likely?
Well, you know, in this partisan atmosphere up on Capitol Hill, I don't know if anything can make things worse, but there was certainly signs of anger, of frustration last night. They were trying to get a vote going. You know, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan looked visibly frustrated as he tried to gavel everybody into order. He spoke this morning about the need for that order, about the possibility of a process and how the Democrats need to respect that process. He actually said that this was not a good day for democracy. So I think House Republicans will talk a lot about that in the coming days and use that as something against their Democratic colleagues.
That is Catherine Gibson along with Michael Lippin. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook, VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA/IE. I'm Ira Melman. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 20th, the international community marked World Refugee Day. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, reports there are over 60 million displaced people worldwide, 20 million refugees, and 40 million internally displaced, the largest number since World War II. Humanitarian crises around the world make painfully clear that despite our best efforts, all nations must do more, said United States Ambassador to Botswana Earl Miller. In an editorial marking World Refugee Day, Ambassador Miller noted that too often refugees and asylum seekers are turned away, denied a safe haven, and refouled or expelled. The United States is seeking commitments to expand the humanitarian safety net and create more long-term opportunities for refugees and displaced people worldwide. We call on our friends and partners to rise to the challenge and honor their commitment on protecting refugees' right to life. One of those friends is Botswana. Botswana currently hosts roughly 3,000 refugees at Dukwi Camp who have fled a wide array of conflicts and violence from as far away as Somalia to as close as neighboring Zimbabwe, Ambassador Miller noted. The government of Botswana, in conjunction with UNHCR, provides them with schooling, housing, and medical treatment. The U.S. government is working to assist where we can. We help fund the camp's health care system, in addition to providing small grants to organizations that offer skills training and safe spaces for the camp's youth. We are working with the government of Botswana and UNHCR to find durable solutions for these refugees. Since 1975, the United States Refugee Admissions Program welcomed over 3.2 million resettled refugees from around the world. In each of the last 3 years, the United States has resettled nearly 70,000 refugees, and this year we aim to resettle up to 85,000. In addition, President Barack Obama announced the United States will admit 100,000 in 2017. The Refugee Admissions Program offers the world's most vulnerable refugees the opportunity to find safety and start over in communities across the United States. While the scope of the global refugee and displaced persons crisis is massive, our humanitarian response can be as well, Ambassador Miller concluded. By welcoming refugees, we reaffirm our common humanity and our commitment to building a common peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.